Okay, it's 11 o'clock, so let's go ahead and get started. We're supposed to be dealing in here with issues related to American spirituality and youth ministry, and I just want to talk to you kind of informally about a few issues that I think are really key issues related to spirituality in America and specifically in dealing with youth. And so I've got five or six things here in my little notes that I've got. And I want to talk for about 35 minutes or so and then open it up for questions. But if you want to raise a question at any point, feel free to do that, because we're not in a real formal mode. I think we're supposed to be done here at 11:45, so you all have time to get over to the lunch at noon. The first thing I want to talk about with regard to American spirituality in dealing with youth is radical secularity. Now, secularity is nothing new. There's a sense in which the American governmental system is based on a secular model, in the sense that we're not theocratic. That is, we don't have a political system based on some combination or collusion between ministers and government. We formed a government back in 1776 and then again in 1787. In 1789, the ratification of the Constitution, which allows for full freedom of religion, and which was based on the idea that there would be some interface between church and state, but no sanctioning of a specific religion, no establishment of church. And so that is a secular kind of government. Another kind of government was formed not long afterwards in France that is based on radical secularity, the complete exclusion of religion from anything related to the state. In fact, many of the people who lost their heads in the French guillotine were themselves priests and bishops, mostly bishops. America never set itself on that kind of a course. But what has happened over time, especially in the late 20th century, is that we have moved more and more in the direction of a kind of radical secularity, sometimes called secular humanism. I've always hated the fact that the term humanism was co-opted by the radical secularists, because humanism in its original meaning had no such focus whatsoever. Some of the most important humanists in history have been people like Martin Luther and John Calvin, but they saw themselves as humanists in the Renaissance sense, which means not only is God an important object of our consideration, but also human beings are an important object of our consideration. Think about Leonardo da Vinci, Da Vinci's portrait of the Mona Lisa. When you look at that portrait, what you see is not a Madonna. She's not a religious figure. She doesn't have a halo. She's not intended to be some kind of depiction of a saint from the Bible. It's just Leonardo's conception of sort of the ideal woman, ideal Italian woman. She doesn't do a whole lot for me, to be honest with you. But she's just a human being, okay? And you can learn a whole lot from just the observation of that portrait. Here is ideal womanhood for Leonardo. And there's nothing anti-religious about it. There's just nothing pro-religious about it. And so humanism, in that sense, was actually a good thing. There needed to be a shift away from an exclusive focus on the church to a recognition that God has made us in his image. But what's happened in our time is that the focus has moved more to a kind of radical secularity, away from any kind of focus on spirituality, or, to use a better word, any focus on God or on the church whatsoever. And recent research has shown, I want to just sort of read something I've off of my notes here, a recent major report into the spirit of Generation Y suggests that young people in our culture today in America are predominantly secular humanist, their worldview revolving around friends and family. This report surveyed a wide slice of the population, but didn't target spiritual or religious young people directly. Instead, it just was a survey of young people in general. And I think that increasingly that's becoming the case. Not so much in your youth group, although it infiltrates your youth group as well, but just school kids in general at public school. The focus is more and more on a kind of radical secularity, the idea that we don't really need God, we don't really need the church. I think this has become even worse since 9/11. I'll talk about why I think that event sparked some of this in just a little bit. But this is one of the issues that you're dealing with whether it's with some kids in your youth group trending that way, and I think we have that happening as well, young people in our youth groups trending that way because they have so many friends who have already trended that way, friends outside of church. And so we have this this real challenge before us of trying to reach people with a gospel message that they consider to be almost completely irrelevant. They've turned not only... It's not just a matter of being indifferent toward the church, it's a matter of being hostile toward the church and hostile toward spiritual things, toward God things in general. I keep wanting to use the word spiritual, and in this context we probably want to stay away from that word except for a real specific kind of usage. So radical secularity is really one of the biggest issues that you're dealing with in trying to reach kids outside the church, and it's one of the big issues that we're all going to deal with when our kids graduate from high school and go on to college. Because on a college campus, especially on a state college campus, they're going to find radical secularity all around them. Now, I realize that depends on which college they go to. My son, when he graduated from high school, went to the University of Northern Colorado. And what he found on that campus, which is not in one of the big cities in Colorado, it's not in Denver, it's in a relatively smaller town outside of Denver, Greeley, Colorado, he found that there was almost no focus on God or even on any traditional way of understanding things like literature. He took a Shakespeare class, and in the Shakespeare class, he was the only student there who actually believed that there was some value in trying to figure out what it was that Shakespeare meant when he wrote Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet. A kind of reader response hermeneutic had taken over not only for the professor but for all the other students in the class. And in fact, they laughed at him when he attempted to try to deal with the original intent of the text. And this is just one of those trends. If you go to U of L here in town, if you were to go to the University of Kentucky, you would find that in the liberal arts area that a radical secularity predominates in almost every course. You occasionally run across a prof who is not inclined that way, but so many of our state schools, this is what you're going to find. In fact, the weird thing about it is that in many of the schools, many of the state schools, the one place where you might actually find some hope of finding people that are not radical secularists is in the philosophy department. And that's because one of the most fruitful fields for evangelism in the last 50 years has been philosophy departments at state universities, primarily through the work of originally two major philosophers, Al Plantinga and Nicholas Wolterstorff. Plantinga now teaches at Notre Dame and Wolterstorff at Yale. And they founded a society called the Society for Christian Philosophers back in the mid-1960s. And they have been actively at work in evangelizing philosophers ever since then, so that many state schools you would go to today, University of Texas, Texas A&M, University of Wisconsin, University of Michigan, you would find some hope in the philosophy department, but not much in the literature department, not much in the history department. My youngest daughter went to U of L for part of her education, and that's what she found there, total hostility. On the other hand, she began her education at Western Kentucky in Bowling Green, and there she found professors who were very much sympathetic with the kind of worldview that she had been raised in. But predominantly what you're going to find today among non-churched youth is a kind of secularity that is maybe not hostile toward religion, but certainly has no interest whatsoever in being involved in religion. And you're going to find that to be the real challenge in bringing those young people into a youth group. It's not to say that you won't have any opportunity whatsoever, but when they initially come in, they're going to come in more because they have friends there than because they're inclined toward believing your worldview. The second issue I want to address in terms of American spirituality is the new atheisms. I mentioned 9/11 a while ago, and 9/11 has been the spur to the development of what has sometimes been called the new atheism. I want to make a point about the new atheism before I talk about some of the literature and some of the issues we're dealing with. One thing about it is that it's not new. Okay, it's just new in the sense that it's gained popularity in recent years and gained a kind of support in popular culture that it hadn't had before. Atheism, for most of history, of course, was looked down upon because we had, in the West, because we had a culture that was broadly based on a Christian worldview or a Judeo-Christian worldview. So really, it wasn't until the 19th century with philosophers like Hegel, who was the first one, so far as I can find, first one in history actually to put into print by a famous guy that God is dead. That's usually attributed to Friedrich Nietzsche later in the century. And Nietzsche did say it, but Hegel had said it before him. I think that Nietzsche never forgave Hegel for having said that first. But, of course, Nietzsche bases his entire worldview on the concept that there is no God, that God is dead, that we've killed God. And when Nietzsche says we've killed God, he doesn't mean that we've actually killed God. What he means is that there never has been a God, and we've finally been able to establish that and prove that, primarily based on Darwinism. This was Nietzsche's major point. Nietzsche's issue when it came to atheism was that human beings are just featherless bipeds. We're featherless bipeds, and what he meant by that is we've evolved just like every other creature has evolved. And since Darwin is right, Darwin published, of course, his thesis in 1859. By the way, Darwin was not the first evolutionist. If you go back to early part of the 19th century, people like Lamarck and others were already spouting evolutionary theory. But Darwin was the first one to, quote, prove biological evolution, or to establish some kind of theoretical framework for establishing biological evolution. Based on that, and based on Nietzsche's own personal nihilism, his belief that there really is nothing out there, he developed the idea that there never has been a God, and we've finally been able to prove that, so we've killed God off. And so for Nietzsche, since there is no God, and since Darwin is right and we are simply creatures that have evolved, there also is no such thing as right and wrong. No such thing as moral and immoral. For Nietzsche, we have to get beyond morality and immorality. And so for him, there's just good and bad. Good being that which is strong and works, and bad being that which is weak and ineffectual. Nietzsche also said, based on that, that the conscience is something that simply has been created by religion. And animal creatures out there don't have any sense of conscience. That's very clear. Even the pets that you have in your house don't have a conscience. You can teach them that they're not supposed to poop in the living room, and they can learn that lesson, some of them, except for Cocker Spaniels, I learned. And when they do poop in the living room, then they'll skulk around and be afraid of you, but not because they have a conscience. It's just because they know what happened last time they did that. When we watched Jurassic Park, the first film, there's the scene where the T-Rex smashes the building, the outhouse that the lawyer's in, and then eats the lawyer, at which everybody claps. I've noticed every time in the theater, everybody claps when the lawyer gets eaten. And then a little bit later in the film, when the two kids and the scientists are up in the tree for protection at night, they're feeding a Diplodocus or whatever it was, and off in the distance they hear the T-Rex roar again. And the girl says, "I hate that type of dinosaur." Anybody remember what the scientist said? It's been a little while since you've seen Jurassic Park, okay? The scientist said, "They just do what they do." And that's right. A T-Rex just does what it does. It eats anything smaller than it, okay? Now, if it's going to eat somebody, you pray it's not somebody in your family, but they just do what they do. It's not an immoral creature. We think of it as immoral, but it isn't. It just does what it does. But human beings have a conscience, and Nietzsche came to the conclusion that that conscience has been instilled in us by religion and by tradition. And because of that, he hated tradition and he hated religion. Well, in the wake of 9/11, atheism has achieved a new prominence. And so whether it's Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins or whoever it might be, these guys are writing books that are accessible to people who don't have a philosophy degree. These books are very influential on college campuses, increasingly even among high school students. They go on college campuses, they go on talk shows and air their views and are treated as if they really have something important to say. I have to be honest with you. I've read their books. I've watched them. I've watched debates between Dawkins and others. I've listened to the interviews. And I find in listening to them that anybody with maybe two semesters of philosophy would not have a difficult time refuting their contentions. It's just not all that smart. But, of course, the thing that they're dealing with and the thing that has found a point of accessibility is 9/11 demonstrates that we have a real problem philosophically, and it's the age-old problem of the problem of evil. And the problem of evil is the congruence of the fact that we believe that God is all good, we believe that God is all powerful, and yet evil exists in the world. And that has always been a philosophical problem for any monotheistic faith. It's not a problem for polytheistic religions. The reason it's not a problem for polytheistic religions is because if you hold that there are multiple gods, and if you're a real devotee of one of the gods, but then you have a terrible day, all you have to conclude is that the god that you're not a devotee of got you that day. Okay, so if you have a religion like Zoroastrianism, where you have a good god and an evil god, it's not hard to explain the problem of evil. Or if you're Odysseus coming back from the Trojan War, he's trying to get back, but of course Odysseus was the one who came up with the solution for how to defeat the Trojans, the Trojan horse, and the patron god of the Trojans was Poseidon, the god of the sea. That's a problem for Odysseus because he's got to cross the Aegean Sea to get back home. And so on his way back home, Poseidon spends 10 years trying to kill him. And he goes through all the different ordeals, the island of the Sirens and the Cyclops and the Scylla and Charybdis and all those other things. And the one thing Odysseus has on his side is that his patron goddess is Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And so she's always able to tell him, here's how you get around this issue. Here's how you get past the island of the Sirens. Here's what you do to the Cyclops. Here's what you do when you come to Scylla and Charybdis and all of those things. So polytheistic religions or dietheistic religions do not have a problem with the problem of evil. But monotheistic faiths of any kind, Jewish, Islamic, or Christian, have a philosophical issue to deal with regarding the problem of evil. And I think that this has become a touch point for a lot of students because they very simplistically hear Hitchens or Dawkins or one of the lesser lights beyond them make these comments that, look, you know, 9/11 proves that God is not here. The Holocaust proves that God is not here. One of the fascinating things, tragically fascinating things, is that out of the Holocaust, there developed in the 1960s a kind of theology, how should I put it, there developed a number of important figures, including a guy named Richard Rubinstein, who was a Jewish theologian, but he was an atheist Jewish theologian. And the reason that he developed his Jewish atheism is because he said, look, God rescued the Israelites in Egypt. He didn't rescue the Jews from Hitler. Therefore, God, somewhere along the way, must have died. And we, in the 1960s, not only Jewish atheism, but also a number of Christian thinkers. Thomas J.J. Altizer of Emory University wrote a book in 1965 or 1966 called The Gospel of Christian Atheism. And so here were people trying to sort of blend Christianity or Judaism with atheism. But in the wake of 9/11, it's become more trendy simply to say there is no God, there never has been a God, the problem of evil establishes that. Now, I think that there are a lot of great arguments to be made against any of those kinds of views. In fact, I would recommend that you pick up Dr. Moeller's book, Isms, which is a wonderful refutation of a lot of that. So especially if you're ministering to young people who have some issue with the new atheism, Dr. Moeller's book would be very helpful. It's interesting, if you go to YouTube and just type in atheism or atheism blog, you'll come up with a lot of video blogs and video clips. One that I saw a few months ago was a young girl, she's probably 15 or 16, who did a regular video blog with her computer camera and then just posted it on her own personal website. And she's just talking very frankly about how she knows that there is no God. And it's a very attractive little piece, and it's the kind of thing that your young people are dealing with in their lives today. The new atheisms. Third issue in American spirituality is what I would just call uncontrolled sexualism. Uncontrolled sexualism. According to the CDC, in 2007, 47.8% of U.S. high school students reported having had sexual intercourse. This has been a little bit of a downward trend. In 1991, the figure was 54.1%. So we can be grateful for a 7% decrease or 6.5% decrease in that. But the difference between 1991 and 2011 is that sexuality has become much more easy for young people to talk about and deal with, especially things like homosexuality and lesbianism. In 1991, those were still considered taboo by many students, but now, because of the trend toward toleration, many young people, even in our churches, don't think that there's anything really wrong about homosexuality. Now, if they believe the Bible and their parents raised them in such a way that they respect God's word, that would be certainly not quite so much the case. But even among young people that I've talked to, and I'm in churches a lot. I'm an interim pastor of a church in Eastern Kentucky. I know that this is the case with some of the kids in my church. We talk about homosexuality, and you can tell that even though they still in the back of their head believe that it's wrong, they can't bring themselves to condemn homosexuality per se, because they have friends. And their friends are involved in the gay lifestyle, and this is just something that they've learned to accept. Somebody said just a couple of years ago, one of the things that is missing from homosexual taboo now is that we no longer have an ick factor in dealing with that. The ick factor has been taken away. When I was in high school and that subject came up, I think most of us would have said, ick. You know, like, who would want to do that? Dr. Moeller was teaching on sexual issues over at Boyce 2 or 3 years ago, and was dealing with things like sodomy, male sodomy. And one of the students came up to him afterwards and said, yeah, whoever would have thought that this was designed to go in there? You can sort of figure that out on your own. But that ick factor has been taken away. So we have to deal with it essentially and almost exclusively as a moral issue, and for us as a theological issue as well. And so even though our young people may not be quite as sexually active as they were 20 years ago, there's altogether too much of it in our churches. In a church that I used to pastor, I sometimes still have dinner with some friends from that church. And a few months ago, we were out to dinner with this couple. And the woman told me, she said, well, I was just sitting in the church. I'm no longer there. I've been gone for a year. But she said, I was sitting in the church the other day, and I was sitting behind two young people in church, a boy and a girl, about 15 or 16 years old. And she said, I sat there and I was just at the angle where I could watch as she masturbated him in church through his pant pocket. So we have these issues, we're dealing with these issues, and sexuality has almost risen to the point of itself being a form of spirituality. And so this is an issue we're dealing with. The fourth thing I want to say some things about here is popular spiritualities. A few years ago, there was a lot of discussion about the New Age movement, and the term New Age movement has kind of dropped out. It's not vogue anymore, but the term that has become vogue, especially in the age of the influence of Dr. Phil and Oprah Winfrey, is spirituality or new spirituality. And so that's the term now. And what happened back in the 1960s especially is that Eastern religious ideas began to drift west. It happened in a number of different ways. Part of the impetus for this was the Vietnam War, where a lot of American GIs went to Vietnam. Some of them became familiar with Zen Buddhism or other forms of Buddhism. They brought it back here. When our veterans are actually experimenting with Eastern spirituality, shouldn't be any surprise that before very long, Richard Gere and Madonna are doing the same thing. And Shirley MacLaine was the actress who did the book Out on a Limb a few years ago. The film came out, Out on a Limb. You may not have seen that. It's quite a ways back. But what happened in the 1960s and afterwards is this focus on alternative spiritualities. And it's developed a kind of impetus and power of its own. I was watching on a Sunday afternoon just a few weeks ago the History Channel as I was sort of debriefing my brain from Sunday morning service and getting ready for Sunday night. And what came on the History Channel was a series, and they showed several episodes. I didn't get to watch it all, but I watched enough of it to realize that this is now on the History Channel, and that is UFO spirituality. This idea that the human race is actually here because somewhere back in the distant past, thousands of years ago, aliens landed on the planet Earth, and they either created human DNA or they did something to initiate the beginning of the human race, or they created some other lower form of animal life that eventually evolved into human life. And there were several episodes where they went to different parts of the world. They went to somewhere in South America, and they went to a place in Egypt and another place in Turkey, and they found these very interesting old ruins. and talked about how these old ruins could only have been built by aliens with alien technology, which of course is ridiculous. Most of the people that they had on there as experts were people who had their, you know, PhD from some mail order catalog or some other kind of credentials like that. They had a couple of real credentialed people, but most of their people were famous because they'd written books on this topic, but not because they had any real credentials. But these are the kinds of things that young people sort of gravitate toward. Well, why are we here? We're here because we were planted here by aliens a long time ago. Angel therapy has become fairly common among people who are interested in alternative spiritualities, this whole angel movement that's out there. One of the things that, youth ministers need to do and that pastors need to do is that we need to teach our young people in our churches what angels really are, okay? They're not cute little cherubs that we put on the back porch, all right? They're not even some kind of winged creature that's standing there invisibly behind us, supporting us in all that we do. The whole notion of guardian angels has almost no biblical support. I say almost no because there's one passage that you could perhaps interpret in that way, but there's nothing in the Bible that stipulates that. We need to teach our young people that angels are messengers. That's literally what the word angelos means. They carry messages from God to people, and they are there also to support us. They are ministering spirits sent out to support us, but they're primarily messenger beings, and they're not beings that we should focus our attention on in terms of worship or some other thing like that. In fact, the Apostle Paul makes it very clear that angel worship is itself idolatry. I'm going to read you a quote here from a young woman who grew up Roman Catholic and then decided that she wanted to be involved in various forms of alternative spirituality. She says, "I try to do things through God." Her name is Stephanie. "I try to do things through God or through the good source, but I still do tarot cards and I still look at star signs. I'm not anti-religion. I'm respectful of people who stand up and actually express to me a spiritual belief." Notice the word spiritual. That's the catch word these days, spirituality. Not everybody talking about spirituality is talking about what we're talking about. And that's one of the things that we really need to keep in mind. "I remember hearing years ago a woman was talking about religion being the different facets of a diamond, and it all comes from the same kind of center. It's just different reflection, and I've always thought that makes some kind of sense." I'm going to talk about uncommitted pluralism in just a minute, so I don't want to drift into that yet. But this is a very common kind of attitude that it's easy for our kids to pick up. Young people, because of the fact that education, and specifically logic, is not being taught in the schools anymore, they have a hard time differentiating between genuine biblical spirituality and some tradition like this that says, well, you can have Jesus, but why don't you take a little bit of this as well? Okay, there's nothing wrong. Read your horoscope, you know, go get your fortune read, go get your palm read. Nothing wrong with engaging in some dabbling in New Age spirituality or alternative spirituality. And this is a real threat. It's a real danger. It's the same danger of idolatry that the Israelites faced in the Old Testament. Because in the Old Testament, the Israelites did not abandon the worship of Yahweh to go worship Baal. They worshiped Yahweh on the Sabbath and then went to the Baal shrine up on the hill and burned incense to Baal as well. It's sort of, let's cover all the bases. This is what idolatry is in the Old Testament. It's an attempt to cover all the bases because of the idea that the gods are out there to bring you success and to bring you happiness. For the Israelites, it was the success of making sure that your crops grew and that your animals had offspring every year and that the grass grew well enough so that the cattle and the sheep could graze on the grass. That was their issue. And if Baal has some power over that, well, what's wrong with worshiping a little Baal as well? We have to teach our young people the importance of not succumbing to any kind of diluting of their faith by including some other form of alternative spirituality in with their Christian faith. A fifth issue is uncommitted pluralism. By uncommitted pluralism, I mean the idea that you can find truth and salvation and spirituality in Christianity, but you can find it in these other religions as well. As best as I can tell, the first time this was really promoted in the West was in 1893. There was a Chicago conference on religion that took place, a world conference on religion that year. And to that conference was invited a very famous Hindu philosopher at the time, a guy by the name of Ramanuja. And Ramanuja was an Indian philosopher who was fluent in English. You might imagine that that would be fairly easy in a country that was controlled by England at the time. And so he was invited to this conference, and he gave the analogy, which we've all heard, but it really comes from this conference in 1893. He gave the analogy that religion or the faith is like a big mountain. And there are many pathways up the mountain, but the important thing is that we all climb our path until we arrive at the top. And that when we arrive at the top, we've all arrived at the top of the same mountain. Now, the biggest problem with that, and I know I'm covering a lot of territory here. I put it on Facebook before I came that I was going to deal with the spirituality issues faced by American youth today. And one person said, how are you going to do that in 45 minutes? So we're just obviously hitting the high points here. But the biggest problem with Ramanuja's analogy is that any universe in which Hinduism and Christianity were both true would be an insane universe. It would be an insane universe because in Hinduism there are 30 million gods. In Christianity, there's one. It would be an insane universe because in Hinduism, everything is essentially one. The appearance of distinctions, like the trees out there beyond the window, or even the individuals in this room, the appearance of plurality is an illusion. And the whole goal in Hinduism is to shed the veil of illusion, the Maya, the veil of Maya, and come to understand that there really is just one. Not in the Highlander sense, but in the sense of there is no such thing as pluralism of objects or pluralism of anything. And once we come to that conclusion, then we find salvation. We find moksha. We enter into moksha and we enter nirvana, in which we are a drop into the ocean. There's no distinguishing the drops in the ocean. And basically we cease to exist as individuated beings. Now that has nothing to do with the Christian eschatology. So any universe in which Hinduism and Christianity were both true would be an insane universe. It would be a chaotic universe. So how do we deal with this kind of pluralism that confronts our young people all the time? It's a real challenge, there's no doubt. I think one thing we can do is we can teach them a little bit about different religions, and I think that you should do that. There's a great book by Wynn Corduan called Neighboring Faiths. Winfred Corduan, he teaches at Taylor University, Neighboring Faiths. And it's written about the world religions. He doesn't have a chapter on Christianity because he's really focusing not on placing Christianity as one among the religions, but as looking at the other religions through the lens of the Christian Bible and Christian theology. It's, I think, the most helpful one-volume work on world religions possible, or the most helpful volume that's out there. One of the nice things about his book is that at the end of each chapter, he has chapters on all the major religions, Islam, Judaism, Buddhism, Shinto, Hinduism, and so on. At the end of each chapter, he has a little section where he says, now suppose you're witnessing to a Shinto, a person who believes in Shinto, what would you say to them? And one of the great things that lends authority to Corduan's book is that he's literally traveled to every one of these parts of the world. He's not just a guy in his study reading books about Buddhism and then writing his own treatment of it. He's been to those places. He's witnessed to Buddhists and to Hindus and to Muslims and to Baha'i people and so on. So I think one thing you can do in sort of combating this problem of uncommitted pluralism is to research and investigate the religions and teach your young people about them. But even more significantly than that, I think it is we need to teach our young people that the resurrection of Jesus Christ is the touchstone for all of reality. And the Christian worldview, culminating in the resurrection of Christ, and the resurrection of Christ, of course, prefiguring the future resurrection and the recreation of a new heavens and a new earth, that is the one solution for the problems that are facing humankind. Christianity is a better worldview. And the capstone of that is the resurrection of Jesus Christ. If Jesus Christ rose from the dead, demonstrating that he is the Lord himself, then that demonstrates that Christianity has something no other religion has. Every other religion is just a philosophy. Christianity has a philosophy, but it really is Christ risen from the dead. And so I think in dealing with pluralism, that's a place to go. Another book I would recommend, and this one's fresh in my mind because I just read it to give it to a friend who's dealing with the suicide of somebody really close to him. And this young man himself is not a believer, is a book called Reasons. It's by Cal Beisner, Reasons. And it's the subtitle is something like A Handbook for Atheists, Agnostics, and Other Skeptics. And it's placed in the form of a dialogue. So you got a college guy named Jim, and he has a friend named Dave, and Dave is an atheist. And so Jim... They're both guys who have had at least a couple of courses in philosophy, and Jim talks him through the whole variety of issues that lead up to conversion, and eventually at the end of the book, Dave is saved. The book was written in 92, but it's still extremely helpful, and the kind of thing that I would give to any person, any young person who's sort of struggling to understand Christianity and to accept it. And that's essentially the argument that he makes, that deal with the resurrection of Christ, and that becomes the real solution to the whole problem of pluralism. And then one final thing I want to say something about, and that's just the whole idea of agnosticism toward truth. A lot of our young people today just are young people who feel like there is no such thing as truth. They're asking Pilate's question, what is truth? And because there's such a cacophony of voices out there. They've heard one thing from mom and dad. They've heard something else from their school teacher. They've heard something else from their friend. They've had experienced, you know, tragedy in their life. I mentioned suicide a while ago. I've dealt with three suicides very, very close to me. I'm dealing with one right now at a church where I'm interim pastor, the minister of music, 1 year ago, October 13th of last year, put a rifle barrel in his mouth and killed himself. And so for the last year, I've been pastoring this congregation through how do we cope with that. And when you deal with a tragedy of that magnitude, you get people who say, well, I just don't know that anything's true. How can I believe in truth? And one of the most important things we can do with people like that is be their friend. Be their friend. In fact, in almost any area of evangelism, while you certainly need to know the Bible and to be able to take people to the Scriptures, and you need to have some apologetics, some tools. By the way, the Apologetic Study Bible is a helpful tool here. I'm one of the editors, so I have to make the disclaimer. I'm going to make a quarter if you buy one. But it does have some very helpful resources in it, including articles on major questions that people raise, and then comments at the bottom of the page of each page of the Bible that deal with apologetics issues there. You need to know the Bible. You need to have some kind of apologetics, but the main thing you need to be is a friend. Okay, I've talked for 37 minutes, so we have about 7 or 8 minutes left. Are there any questions?
Going back to the Hindu
Hinduism certainly would fit that, because there are many paths to Hinduism. You have yoga as one path. You have the Bhaktivedanta tradition as another path. You've got a number of different things in Hinduism that are different ways to the goal. But to say that that is characteristic of all religions, that all religions are on that same mountain, is just, I mean, I think it would be even difficult for most Hindus to say that the Buddhists are on our mountain, even though Buddhism is a Hindu cult. Buddhism is such an alternative approach that Hindus would say, well, no, that's not us. So, yeah, good observation. Other questions or comments?
I know we use a lot of terminology that digs in to help us understand different things, what people believe and stuff, but I see a common thread between all of it, and it's a sin that goes back to the very beginning. It's just a self-centeredness.
Yeah, self-centeredness is right.
And,
yeah.
They see that, a lot of young people, I throw myself in that category, but we don't want to be told what to do, and any kind of authority figure in our life, we want to rebel against that. And God being the ultimate authority, whatever His Word says for us to do as a people,
or
as creation, we're just going to defy that.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, the serpent came to the woman and said, "Hath God said, and thou shalt not surely die?" And she, of course, took of the fruit and ate and gave to her husband, and he ate. And so that was rebellion against authority. That's what sin essentially is. And anybody that's raised kids knows that kids have a rebellious streak. They have an Adam nature. They have an Eve nature. I have a 2.5-year-old grandson that we've had with us all week long. We picked him up last Saturday, and thankfully my son's coming to get him today. You know, they say that they're the two most beautiful kinds of lights in the world are Christmas lights and taillights down the driveway. And we've really enjoyed having Buck with us this week, but there have been moments when his little 2.5-year-old defiant Adamic nature has flared itself up, you know. And I've contended for years you should never teach your children the word no. I mean, it's a good thing for us to use, but they pick it up real quick. No, I don't want to do that. So, yeah, rebellion and defiance is in our heart. And I think that a lot of childhood rebellion can be ameliorated by parents who stay very close to their kids. Somebody mentioned family ministry a while ago. If there's any failure that I would see in my years of pastoral ministry, it is the failure of parents to really be in their kids' faces in both the good and bad way. I mean, and not bad, in both a disciplinary way and in a discipling way. And it's easy for us to kind of back off of some of the parental responsibilities because we're tired. Life is complicated. You come home and, you know, you got a whiny kid and you don't want to deal with a whiny kid, so you just let him whine. And parents need to be much more committed to seeing themselves as the primary pastoral figures in their children's lives and to realize that that's where it starts. And I have to disciple my children as well as discipline my children. And we all have failures at that. We all look back years later. My kids are all grown. They've got kids. I look back and realize I could have done better. But on the other hand, my children all know the Lord, and they're now in that same position I was in 25 years ago of trying to nurture their children in the admonition of the Lord. But it's a never-ending task. And so I think we can help to bring our children to the place where they learn how to cope with that rebellion against authority better, but not by letting them get away with rebelling against authority. Yeah. Yes.
I don't know how I'm asking this, but there's almost like they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, or is there a shift that's happening right now where they're attacking us intellectually, everything's got to be based on logic, everything, which I think
yeah.
Where, so, you know, does that make sense?
Well, it does make sense. And one of the fascinating things about the last, I guess it's been going on for better than 20 years, 30 years, but there's been a new focus on it just in the last couple of years, and that is what is sometimes called the new physics. And the new physics is the idea that physics and spirituality can be the same thing. And what some of the new authors who are writing on this topic, I'm trying to think of a name or two in my head, what some of the authors are saying who write on this subject is that at the essence of the material world is something that's not material, that there's a kind of spirituality at the essence of it, not spirituality in the biblical sense, but spirituality in the sense of non-materiality. And some of them are even trying to equate that with God. But what if you follow the logic of that, then you have pantheism, because if God is just another way of saying the world, then that's just a new version of the old 18th century or 17th century Leibniz and Spinoza pantheism. And that's not helpful to anyone. For one thing, if God slash spirituality as it is at the essence of the materiality of our universe, it's not personal, because the universe is not personal. It is impersonal. And if there's anything that we need for God to be, it is that we need God to be infinite and personal, not just infinite. This was Francis Schaeffer's contention back in the 1970s and 80s, that the biblical God is the infinite personal God. And only an infinite personal God can really satisfy the needs that we have for things like forgiveness. I mean, if you think about it, and this gets back to the whole issue of the resurrection of Christ again, the one thing that we need, just in a sense of felt needs, and I realize just talking about felt needs is not the only important thing to do. We need to talk about real needs. But this touches us at both the level of felt need and real need, and that is to have a rock-ribbed certainty that we are forgiven. There's no rock-ribbed certainty of forgiveness in any of the other world religions. In Hinduism, guilt is an illusion. You just ignore it. In Islam, you don't know what you're going to get, because Allah is a tyrant, and he might accept you in, but he might not, even if you've been a good Muslim, even if you adhere to the five pillars and believe in the five doctrines and believe in the prophets and all of those things. Allah is a God who could simply reject you. You walk across the bridge into heaven, and he turns up on its edge like a knife blade, and you're down in the pit, which is one of the reasons why self-inflicted martyrdom is relatively common in Islam, because that's the one way to be sure. You could be a good Muslim, go to Mecca, make your pilgrimage, do all those things, and still not be accepted by Allah. So Christianity, and specifically Protestant Christianity, is the one tradition, the one world religious tradition where you can find assurance of forgiveness. And so there's that real felt need. What felt need do we have that is more important than that? Because we live in a world filled with people who are filled with guilt. I think we're out of time, but I'd be glad to stay around. We'll take one more question. Yeah, I do. I do believe that. And if we had time, I would launch into an excursus on the problem of evil, but that would take us through lunch. So, but yes, I would say that. Yeah.
Since that one was kind of short, could you possibly give us maybe a few more resources? Maybe even reading on, more postmodernism, like resources that you would trust that would inform us more and more on how to better understand maybe culture and do a good job.
Yeah, David Dockery edited a series of essays on postmodernity, and the exact title, I don't recall, but it's got the word postmodern in it. But if you look up David Dockery and look for a book with the title, with the word postmodern in the title, it's a really fine series of essays on this topic. John Piper's written some things on this. You just kind of look through his resume, and you'll find mostly occasional things that he's done, and he's done some preaching on this in these areas as well. Of course, Piper's a great resource for almost any of these issues. there's a book by Millard Erickson also on postmodernism. Millard is M-I-L-L-A-R-D, Erickson. He's got a very helpful book on postmodernism. He quotes me a couple times, so that's when anybody quotes you, you always like their book, so. Yes.
What is the book that you referenced earlier talking about?
Yeah, Neighboring Faiths by Winfred Corduan. Corduan. He teaches at Taylor up in Upland, Indiana, and a very fine scholar. We've had him here on our campus a couple times since I've been here. I think it's the best book for it. It's not as exhaustive. You could find more exhaustive treatments, but I think that for the kinds of things that we're dealing with, I mean, if you pastor in an area where you have a lot of Japanese people and you need to really understand Shinto, you'll probably want to go deeper than that. But for most of us who deal with youth in our churches with questions about religion, other religions, that's the best book.
Is that a book that you could read?
They could, yeah. Yeah, it's very accessible. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd want to read it with them because they might have questions about some of the terminology. But he does a good job of defining his terms. It's just extremely accessible. In fact, I have a family that I've done some mentoring with, and they're homeschooling their boys. And I gave them a copy of the book, and their oldest boy read it along with the parents and then talked about it with the younger boys. And the older boy, who's a high school student, was able to understand it very well.
95% of my students go to a public school or go to a state school.
Are you in Kentucky?
No, sir.
Okay. Number one resource to put in the hand of a parent. Yeah. Boy. I have to think about that. Catch me at lunch. Okay? Because that's a very good question. Nobody's asked me that question in a while. So, but let me think about that. You're talking about just preparing them intellectually for what they're about to face. You know, one book that does come to mind is Apologetics to the Glory of God by John Frame. Because I think it's apologetics is in some sense more important for Christians than it is for unbelievers. And that book gives about the best treatment of apologetics that I know anywhere. And so helping young people to be formed in their faith and their worldview is really the most important thing you can do for them before they go off to school. And I think that book does a great job of it. Apologetics to the Glory of God, John Frame. All right, well, we're going to have lunch. I'd be happy to talk to any of you more at that point. Thanks for coming.